Steve Coulter, how you doing, buddy?
I'm pretty good, actually. It's very hot. Where are you? Are you in Texas
I was
still,
about
or
to ask you the same question.
I
Your
asked you
closet
first.
invites a lot of questions. I'm gonna go first. I'm from Texas. I was there the last time we spoke on the show
Yeah.
for the Bent series that we did with your
Good.
lovely daughter and so many pickles that were involved. At the time, I was there, but I'm in Los Angeles where I live
Oh, okay.
100% of the time now.
Well, great. Great. Yeah, it's hot. It's very. I'm in Atlanta, and it's
Right.
yeah. I have a dog here. I'm dog sitting, and this dog follows me everywhere, which is great. But he's like, I always think he's
That's
something
what
in.
I want from dogs. I don't know if you, are you a dog person
I'm
generally?
a big dog. We don't. We used.
Me
I used to
too.
have a dog. Haven't in a few years, but we have a friend that we dog sit their dogs whenever they go away, and it's so great.
It's
It's
kind of
just.
like being a dog grandparent. You get to have them
It
for the
is.
weekend, spoil them a
Yes,
little bit,
exactly. Yes,
and
you don't have
send
to
them
pay for
packing.
vet bills, and yeah, and these are real snuggly dogs. They're big cat of dogs, but they sleep with us.
I love that.
Wait,
That's
so
wonderful. We talked last time, as I mentioned, about the Bent series, and we really got into that show and why you were doing it
yeah.
and the gravitas of all that. And then, of course, unbeknownst to us, the world imploded, just 20 minutes
Crazy.
after we talked.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so I got to start it off with the stock question that you haven't been asked yet. It's the only thing that I ask everybody, which is, where are you from, Steve?
I was born in Canada, and I'm actually still Canadian, even though I left when I was about three. And for whatever reason, I just kept my citizenship. And we moved around a lot. Not like, I know a lot. It's funny, a lot of actors come from military families and stuff. So we moved around. We moved to Connecticut, and we moved to South America. Then we moved to Cleveland,
For
which
military reasons?
no military reasons at all. And it was like we would and we didn't lose a lot. We would live one place for a long time, but it's still great that you get to, like, for example, living in South America. I lived in Colombia. It was back when it was a very safe place. But kids there were, they, I guess they just matured earlier. So when I went from South America, and like the school where I went to was kind of an international school. There were Americans, there were Colombians, a lot, mostly Colombians. And then I moved to Cleveland, Ohio, which was this heated, and for ninth grade, which, and I moved to a neighborhood that everyone had grown up with each other. And it was more of a culture shock than moving to South America. Because, I moved there. I remember it was the night before I was starting school, and I was listening to like a radio show, and they were talking about, people were calling in afraid of clicks, and I didn't know what that expression meant. I didn't know what a
I don't know
click.
it.
It's, a group of people, like a
Oh,
clique.
clicks like a click of people.
Yeah, and
It didn't occur to me that one would perceive that as dangerous, so I didn't think that's what
yeah,
you were
people
talking about.
were saying, and I. It was even scarier to me because I didn't know what this thing was. This
They spell
so
it with a
many,
Q or something? How
yeah.
very terrifying.
I was already terrified because I didn't know anybody, and I wasn't
Right.
like a really social kid. So now I had to go to school, like it was almost like a horror movie. I was like, I'm afraid of this thing that I don't even know. I soon learned what a click was, but yeah. And then so I was there. Then I went to the school, North Carolina. Then I went to New York. And then, yeah, then I came to Atlanta.
What were your folks doing that was causing the move? Was it
My
personal,
dad was,
professional?
he was, my dad, he was, he worked for an aluminum company. He was like a
Okay.
business. It was funny.
Sales?
Yeah, he was kind of a, it was Alcan Aluminum, which is like the equivalent of Alcoa, I guess. And
Okay.
he got his job down in South America, which was kind of a dream job for him. He got to run a plant, a factory, and he loved it. And it was kind of cool because we got to be rich for 4 years because the company paid for everything.
That's the
We had,
perfect amount, Steve. Am I
well, we
wrong?
went, yeah. Well, I got to tell you, it was really it's ridiculous because we in the States we were middle class. Then we went to
Right.
South America. We had a house. It had not only had a swimming pool, it had rivers that went underneath the house. I had my own soccer field, like my own soccer field. I had a horse. We had, this is so crazy. We had a maid. a cook, an ironing woman, a chauffeur, and a gardener. The gardener was my best friend.
You'd be lucky in America with a great corporate job if you get a Kia Forte.
Yeah,
That's the
it was weird
best.
because, well, I guess because it's how the society ran. Like, even if, like, my dad had a good friend that worked for the company that had an apartment, and even he
Right.
had a maid because it was there's a whole stratus of the population that
Right.
you're supporting that. And it was weird because then you come back to Cleveland, and it was really weird when I was little. I was 9 or 10 when I moved. By the time before I left, like the last year, I was 12, 13. I was very uncomfortable with that, so I hung out with the cook and the gardener. Like, I'd eat dinner with them instead of my parents because I was like,
Interesting.
yeah, it was odd. And it was very sweet. Then I moved to Cleveland and we're back to middle class America, which is
Was there
fine.
resentment from you at all on that mo on that move? All that stuff went away?
No, I was actually looking forward to it because it was weird. My mom hated it because she was like, when we lived in the States, she had a job. She did, she was, back in that era, the late 60s, she was a housewife, but she had a job and she did a lot of volunteering work and stuff. And so when she got to South America, she hated it. There was nothing for her to do. She
Never
didn't.
adapted to that and was like, oh, this is the new thing. She was like,
Yeah,
it's not me.
definitely not, was not her. Yeah,
Got it.
she was very independent. And so when she was, it was good to move back. And I just, back then, I'm sure it's different. It was not like it was an English thing. There was not a TV. Like, TV there started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was all in Spanish.
Yeah.
And then movies too. You wouldn't get you once in a while you get a new release. But the fun thing was that I'd see old movies like Gone with the Wind and The Great Escape on a big screen. So I went to a lot of movies. But moving back to the States, I was really glad because you could read American newspapers and Sports Illustrated and stuff. So, but it was great because the perspective was that I just all our teachers were like former Peace Corps workers, so they're these young, motivated, fun, interesting. And I came to the States, and I had like American history teacher who put everyone to sleep, and it was like I thought because I used to love school, and
Right.
then being this boring thing, and so it was a great little exposure to a different world. And so,
Siblings?
yeah, I got, let's see, I got two older sisters. I was like, I think I was a mistake.
Sure.
I'm way after, like, by the time I was 9, everyone had moved out of the house.
It.
And
I've got a sister who's 9 years older than me, so I
yeah,
relate to that. Yeah, big
yeah,
gap.
yeah, yeah. So they were always kind of like, I had a brother who I never really even knew them, but he's
Right.
since passed away, but. But they were kind of these magical people that would visit on Christmas or something like that.
And brother means something very different to you than like friends who are like, yeah, my brother who I have to sleep in the next room with and all
Yeah,
that.
I
You've got a
never had
completely
that.
different
I just
relationship.
yeah, no, I did share when I was little. I shared a bunk bed with my sister who tortured me. Not it wasn't abuse, but
Right.
she was like she would. She told me she was a robot, and I said no. But what about your veins? She goes, those are my wires. She tried to make me cry in front of my best friend. It was like, and now she goes, oh, I adored you. It was like, no, you didn't. You didn't adore
That's a
me.
weird way to show it, honey.
Yeah, you
That is
closed
so
the door on my
funny.
head to see if I would cry. It was like, yeah, I cried. I cried a lot. I was like, yeah. But now
So
we have.
where does the creative stuff come in? Are mom and dad creative people?
No, I mean, not my dad was, he was. Like, he was great at making off the cuff speeches. He was very funny, but in terms of he was just business of my mom. There's a lot, like, especially wives in that era, who knows what they would have become.
Exactly.
No, I think I remember I saw a play in about, I think it was 7th grade. It was they're doing there was like a little community theater group in America of American little English people. It was English speaking, and I saw this play, and I remember thinking, I actually said I have to do that. It was kind of corny, but that bug thing, and it
That
was very.
story comes up all the time on this show.
It's well, I was
It's
almost
real.
pathologically shy because I remember, when you go through and in like English class, and you're each person would read a
Read a
paragraph,
paragraph,
you would
right?
be coming down the line, and I would start sweating. And one time I even started, I was doing a presentation in front of class and I started crying.
Oh,
And then
man.
go in with me to talk to your teacher about what are we going to do about Steve's shyness. But I saw that play, and then a couple of friends of mine and I, we did one of those little, they used to be like play magazines, and we picked some play and did it. And so when I got to the States, they had like drama club, and I thought, oh, I'll do that. And then I had a teacher, it was kind of cool. Then I was in ninth grade, it was junior high, which I guess they call middle school. And they had this program, it was called, what was it called? A humanistic curriculum. So for English, science, and social studies, it was a much more like for so you go out and do stuff. And for English, like this one woman had been an actor, I think, and she taught an improv class. And I just really took to that. And then one thing led to another. And I took acting classes at the Cleveland Playhouse, which is like their repertory company. And then I found out you could actually train to do this for a living. I almost became a cartoonist, came very, this close because I cartooned a lot out of boredom and
doodling and stuff.
Yeah, that's how I got through the boring. I used to do
right in the corners
things.
Of all your,
and I'd
yeah.
done some like children's books and stuff. And Emerson College in Boston had mm-hmm. a really good theater department, but in their little, remember those catalogs you get? I don't know, instead of it was nothing online. They
right,
advertised,
right.
They had a cartooning program. And I was like, well, this would be perfect. I can
right.
And I went in an interview and they said, well, we don't really have that program yet. It's like, okay.
You sold it to me.
Yeah. And I ended up, I auditioned for like Carnegie Mellon, which I hated. I went there, I drove from Cleveland with this best friend of mine. And I sat down and this guy with an accent, he had a name tag and he slapped it on me. And I remember I turned to this friend of mine and I go, I don't want to go there.
Right.
And when I auditioned
I can
for school,
smell it.
Yeah, it was just like, the fate or whatever was like, you're not going to go here.
What do you think it was? So I have a couple of questions before we get too much
yeah.
farther. One of them is, and this may be the quicker one, what put you in a place of personal confidence at that age to feel that impulse and follow it and not be like, hey, maybe getting smacked around a little bit is going to be part of the next thing in my life, you know? Like there's
yeah.
something in you that went off and went red light, not doing it. That's
yeah.
That feels like a kind of an integrity moment for someone who's what, 17, 18?
Yeah, I was 17 really. And 16 when I knew that, it was funny. I did a play in high school in my junior year, 11th grade. It was called David and Lisa.
Okay.
About these two emotionally disturbed kids. I was David. And it went off really, really well. And a woman came up to me after and she said, are you a professional? Did they bring you in from outside? And it was the first time that I went, well, I think maybe I'm good at this. I mean, I know I like
that sounded it. Like a compliment.
Yeah. And it was the first thing I was like, okay. Because again, I was very, still very shy.
Of course.
And then I think, so I got, and I started getting larger parts. It's funny. One thing that's funny in high school, you start off in little parts. I played a butler in 10 Little Indians. But then they graduate, so you got to.
Right.
They don't have that. And well, now I guess if people die, but then you can sort of step up if you're pretty good,
right?
And I really, really liked doing it, and I got good feedback, and that must have been. This was the only thing I really had a passion for. Wow, and I did get that. I auditioned for. There's a professional program at SUNY Purchase, and mm-hmm. They were really interesting because I went to this school in Purchase, New York, whatever, and they had this old dean, this British guy. I think he had a cravat or whatever that's called.
Oh, of course, a neckerchief.
And but he was great because he, of all things, I showed the monologue I did was from Dr. Faustus, which is like a King Lear of roles. There, and this little 17-year-old from
right.
Ohio,
yeah,
voice was like that. And he said, well, first of all, I'm going to call you back because I see something in you, but by good God, do not do that piece.
Right.
He said, maybe in 50 years. And then the way this, so that kind of gave me,
That was before the Emerson sticker moment.
Yes. Why should I have gone to Emerson before? And
that
was after Carnegie Mellon. And I was like, and I felt I really wanted to go there because it was right outside of New York.
The Mellon.
And they were interesting because they did their callbacks in the city at acting studio. So they wanted to conduct it like a real job. And I didn't get in. And I'd already lined up an audition at North Carolina. And I remember when I got to the campus, I really liked how they treated me. They had a new, I think the new, it hadn't really been before the year or two before I got there. It had been, you know, 4 years, but the classes were intermixed. They would do plays, you'd audition for plays. But the faculty before that, the dean and the assistant dean came over from England. You might have heard of Malcolm Morrison.
Yeah.
And so they were going to, that's when they had separated the classes, so you were a company. But I really liked how they treated me. They're very kind. It seemed more practical. Like at Carnegie Mellon, they had me sing Happy Birthday. And I was like, why are you having me sing?
What do you learn about that? And maybe you're starting in 77?
Yeah, that's why I started in 77.
Got it.
And I remember when I was leaving, I was going up this, you know, down where the elephants are. I don't know if they still have, but there's a staircase going up to where the high school was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was walking up there to go to the parking lot. And I remember thinking, I'm going to go here. And it wasn't an arrogant thing.
Right.
It was just sensed. I went, it just felt right. And yeah, so then
clearly.
They sent me the envelopes with, it was a thicker envelope. So you went, oh, okay. So this is, so that's how.
It's always fascinated me, man. I mean, people who listen to this show know I really am generally very interested in two things about this situation that we all share, which is how did you get there? And then how did you deal with what happened when you left? Because that next, and I choose those words carefully as I describe that second part, especially because I mean, I'm such a fanboy of the school. I didn't know it existed until right before I decided to go there.
Interesting.
And it was never on my radar to go to any college. I was such a dog shit student whole life. I was like, there's no way. And
how did you hear about it? Were you in Lydigate, Texas then?
I was. And my best friend, who was doing all the same plays as me and all the same different stuff around town, but was not a dog shit student and was very diligent in all his advanced classes, was, you know, being seen as someone with potential, and adults were holding his hand to go to unified auditions and to get ready for those things. And that was never even really he's not going to college, we know this, so like, you know, he's got good luck with your talent, you have some, but it's not going to be this path for you. And I agreed with them initially, but then after he was at school for, I want to say the first year was when he really got it in my head. He was like, I've known you since fifth grade, man. And I know you hate school, but this is not what you think it is. It is different. And if you came here and didn't do the academics at all, you may not get a bachelor's degree, but you'll get the training of this place. And he's like, I think you can do this training for 12 hours a day and do your homework and turn it in and give a shit. And he's right. I actually started in DMP. I don't know if I ever told you that.
I didn't know that.
So I was a lighting designer first. And then I ended up being Gerald Friedman's last directing student. That's where I fall in the.
Oh, okay. Canon. Wow.
Yeah. So quite a sidestep journey. And I think that's why I'm so interested in, like I said, how people end up in the position to be there, one way or the other. So then I think I already have the answer to this, but you went straight from high school in the spring to NCSA in the fall, right?
Yeah.
With a summer off in between Cleveland High School and this conservatory acting program, right?
And it's weird because I don't know if you felt this at the time, and I don't know if it's just I'm an old guy or now, but when I was 17, like now I think, oh my God, 17. Like I have a stepson now, I was 14. And
right.
When I was, not to go into details, but I had a volatile teenage year. It was pretty. So I think that aged me in a certain. I don't mean me old, but
I had a volatile teenage years in Ohio.
And I felt I felt like an old. I felt older, a lot older when I got there. But even though I think now, my God, I've barely been on the planet for very long.
I've been doing this podcast for so long, man, and talking to people, of course, plenty of times, all the time, not on the show. I was at an alumni event last night here in LA, which was awesome. And I'm obsessed with this conversation, and I feel like the opinion that I am forming, and this is why I'm so excited to talk to you from being, and I have talked to people from like before my time, But I haven't talked to that many people who were there in like 70s, 80s. I've talked to some more 90s folks. And myself, I was 2013, should have been 10 if I had gone right in.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating to me, this thing. The opinion that I'm slowly forming is the conservatory classical training that was predominant at the time that you were there, because that was the entire idea of the school, was to provide an alternative to what was a growing liberal arts movement in other places, right? So over time, you can see clearly with the addition of a liberal arts program to the school, now offering all the degrees, the U added little stuff to big stuff. There is a continued kind of, how do we cope with the fact that society in America in education seems to really want these kids to get a diverse education, even if they don't wanna. We'll try to support and endorse their artistic endeavors, but we need them taking math until they're 22. We need them taking science until they're 22. And the thing that obviously clicked with me, as I just shared with you, was not having to be good at those things in order to be treated as someone with artistic value in the community. And what I've found, and I would love your perspective on this as far as like how many people were in your class who actually were older versus right out of high school, if any, but the people who go straight in have a lot more trouble coping with that training without any kind of gap or any kind of other experience. It can be incredibly taxing on a 17-year-old, as you just mentioned, who's young. To be broken down in this way, to be assessing traumas, things like that. Your thoughts?
You're good with the questions, young man. it's interesting because before I leave my little break, I had a guy who became my very good friend. He had already been to 4 years of college, and he had a much easier time adapting because he's had more life. But I think I had had some because of the little, my adventures as a teenager.
Volatility.
Yeah. But what shocked me was how hard it was right away. I never, ever, I hurt my back like the second class. I was gymnastics and I hurt my back and I was so fucking miserable. I really thought I'm not going to make it because
I wasn't built for it.
No, and that much is voice and movement and singing, and they did. And one thing I disagree with how they did it then, like, because when I haven't taught in a while, but whenever I have taught, I would always come with the assumption, and I would tell actors, you have a talent for this now, or unless you're deluded about yourself, I mean, there are those people. But I said,
many as people like to think.
Yeah, well, and it's like you've you had this confidence to actually do this, and I would start from that. And because a lot of times I would say, there's so many classes, for example, immediately start teaching you stuff. I said, well, wait, they may know things already. It may be rough. And they didn't do that then. And so with that respect, it was kind of antagonistic, is like, you can't talk, which is true. Like I said, my voice was here,
right?
Hard posture. I wasn't, I was not a dog shit student, but I was a very average student in high school. I didn't excel. I was like a B, maybe an A now and then. Did terrible on the SATs. It was almost,
I never took them.
Laughable. So I was totally overwhelmed. And fate gave me, though, a roommate. There's this guy, his name was Kick Bynum. This guy who was from Rocky Mountain, North Carolina.
His first name was Kick?
Yeah, James Kick Bynum, because he was a martial arts phenom. He was one of these.
That is such a cool, like, 80s name, too.
Yeah, and he was just, and this guy, he was so disciplined.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, literally, we had 40 or 41 actors that arrived on a Friday. By Monday or Wednesday, whatever, over the first weekend, I think four left because they were like, this is not going to happen. If I had not had him as a roommate, I don't think it would
have been five.
What happened is I somehow chose, there was something competitive in me. I was like, I'm going to match his level. It was also very encouraging, but also like he would get up really early. So I'd get up early. And then he was working on his voice. I have a grumbling voice. He would, and that somehow that first term, I remember like Leslie Hunt was the voice teacher, and I remember she even said, you had your evaluation, she said, I didn't think you were going to make it. And once I made it past that first, when is the trimester? Yeah, because I was fully overwhelmed and I didn't have that much self-confidence. I remember sitting around, there were a lot of theater people singing theater songs, and I felt like such an outsider. And I didn't, and no one was going, you're really great. You know, that's why you got into the school, which is like, I wish someone had, because I would just kept, I was holding on by the like teeth to get through it. And I was remember being really miserable. And I was lucky in that at the beginning, you know, that first year, I don't know how it was with you. You didn't do any scene work or plays.
Right.
All just classes. And I remember feeling just buried. I remember thinking, I'm not standing upright. I'm not talking right. I'm not whatever. And luckily, there was a teacher who was a director. She was also an alcoholic. But we did this play, and we had there was a little get-together in one of the dorms, and she happened to come to it. She was a little tipsy, so she was talking. And she told me, she said, when we first saw your audition, we were blown away. Like, who is this kid? And I think that, because the second year back then was the hardest year. We had a couple of nervous breakdowns in the class. The second year was the hardest year in terms of just volume of work. But if it hadn't been for that, where it said, she said, you have a talent for this. And I think that, it was just luck. If I thought, I might not have made it either.
But how many students out of the 35 were older when they entered the program?
Boy, not many. You know, there was this guy, Craig Sisler. I'm still very good friends with him. And then there was a couple of people that, and it was so interesting what that school, because it was so hard. It kind of broke a lot of people. There was a woman, my old name, who I remember thinking, she just radiated talent. She just had an inner confidence. I think she was about 3 years older. She'd had a bit of a rough time. What was interesting is the second year broke her. And I remember thinking, I remember even as a friend and a colleague, I thought, no, because she was so good.
And yes, I've seen that happen.
Well, there's some people, I remember, you know, they did, I don't think they do this anymore. At the end of the second year, they did this cutting, and you'd get the spray.
They stopped doing it in the early 2000s, and then I want to say about 10 years into the 2000s, they were still cutting people at the end of the second year, not by like half or like an arbitrary, we need to get rid of this many, but they were still doing like, you're not showing up, kid. Like, you're not putting it in. We cast your talent and your talent is still there, but we're not convinced this is as important to you as it needs to be for us to keep training you. So you got to go. You're not invited back. They were still doing that. By the time my class started, that mentality was totally out the window. You had to piss somebody off to get kicked out.
And I'm so glad they don't, because first of all, when I becoming a parent, and I said, I'm up to the school, if they kicked her out, I would have burned the school down.
Of course.
But I remember thinking, after those first few years are so hard to be asked to leave, but a phenomenon was interesting, and I wonder if it happened, well, I guess it couldn't have happened with you guys, but for example, we had this one actor, she was kind of overweight, not their tip, but she was good. But because of tension, she never really excelled in classes and scene work and stuff. And then it's interesting, they gave her a note saying she was being asking her to leave artistic.
Not asked back, probation, but, or whatever.
It was right before intensive arts. And then she did a project in intensive arts where she just soared because she was doing what she wanted to do. And they asked her, no, we want you to stay. And she's basically said, fuck you, I'm not going to. And
that's
badass. Yeah, it was interesting because it was a lot of people in intensive arts did some of their best work because they were picking something they wanted to do, and their talent showed again. I had my college girlfriend. We were very in love, and it was my junior year. I had just won some, they had an award. I won some scholarship, so I was like, yeah. And then she got a letter saying she's being asked to leave.
Oh,
and I went to the snack bar and I threw a trash can through the window.
Yeah,
I was very mad.
Yeah.
But I did tell them, back up. That's what I was wearing. I was
You're
like,
safety conscious. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I need to step back up. I'm not mad at you.
This demonstration is with your safety in mind, but it is absolutely necessary.
She was traumatized. And I know people
of course. My girlfriend was kicked out when I was a first year.
And they don't. And it's like a scar that's because you invested so much of literally your soul and your heart. And then to say, you don't have the maturity then to go, well, that's their opinion. I mean, very few people.
Right. Right.
And I just thought that was almost, you know, I know, and there have been allegations, you know, the sexual stuff that happened, that, you know, all the lawsuit, which is horrific.
Of course.
There's also kind of an emotional abuse that I thought that was just, and I did at the time, I thought, well, I guess that's just how it is. But, you know, as an older person looking back, it's like, that's just, you can't do that. It's just acting. You know, it's like, and they were also cutting the art classes down. If, for example, our graduating class, you became a company. It was called The Company.
Mm.
You were in three plays in repertory at the school, and then you went on tour. We toured all up the East Coast, all over North.
Right. There used to be more of a transition into a professional mindset than there later was.
And so they had to kind of cut down. And I'm really glad they don't do that anymore. Because people, God, I think of the damage done to people who are rejected at that young age that just never really got over it. I know people
and
now
this... This is the rub there, Steve, 100%, because the question is this: how might we solve both problems? Because you have this group of people who are tremendously talented, that if you smash them into the ground while they're trying to learn, you're going to smash the talent out of them, or at least the enthusiasm to pursue it. Then you have this other group of people that if you apply focused pressure on, that's what they need to succeed to get to that level. And you have this gray area of what any individual who is entitled to their own feelings and opinions on what is abusive to them.
Yeah.
If it's sexual or physical, that's quantifiable. We can just be honest about, hey, this happened or didn't happen. But when you get into verbal abuse, which is real, when you get into emotional abuse, which is real, we've got to start parsing what exactly that means and how it affected people. And I think the thing I'm coming up with as a complete amateur who talks to his therapist's wife every night is they're too young for this.
That's a good, they're too young for this.
There is a place for that in a way that is done ethically. But 17-year-olds, by and large, and maybe we could argue even more so today than 40 years ago, are not prepared for that level. We do mental fitness and physical fitness tests for the military that are so rigorous that people who want to be soldiers with their whole being aren't allowed to because they're not, sorry, we checked you out and you're not ready for this. It might destroy you. But we let these kids go into the 70-hour-a-week emotional turmoil thing on an interview and how good they did with their monologue from Faustus. You know, it's like,
and it's also there were some people who were asked to leave because they just fucked up. They wouldn't show
up. Like,
hey, I'm doing, and that's fine. That's not,
and they're in the way of your work,
exactly. And that's a consequence. But when you have someone, because talent is so subjective, I'll never forget.
Of course,
I remember there was an intensive arts, and it was the only time they do, you know, workshops in the morning, and then you do your little practice and stuff. And I was doing a scene study class, and there was a guy who was two classes before me, and he was doing, I think I was doing some American, like Arthur Miller or something.
Okay.
And he was terrible. I remember thinking, and it taught me a big lesson, though, that I remember when I was directing or teaching, and I just thought, I remember thinking, this guy should not be an actor. He just doesn't have it. But then like 2 years later or a year later, they were doing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And he was playing
Tom Sopper,
And it was, you know, the stylized, heightened language. And he was fun. Just gave me goosebumps.
Right.
He was phenomenal because that was his thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, I went, oh my God, I was so wrong. I'm like, yeah, maybe he can't do Arthur Miller or Sam Shepard. But my God, I could not come close to doing what he's doing. And I remember thinking, When I taught like scene study classes, I would always try to find, like I say, well, this is not in their wheelhouse. And some actors have a wider wheelhouse. And that was the thing about asking people to leave that's so subjective of like one thing. I mean, one guy was asked to leave because he really never lost his North Carolina accent. But he was such a good actor. And I don't understand, like, you know, then you think of Holly Hunter or people.
Yeah,
Who's
I was
like,
just about to cite like 40 people that eliminate that argument.
Yeah, well, and a part of it, they were training repertory theater actors. So
sure.
It was an era. And when we graduated, by the time we graduated in 1981, there was very few repertory theater companies. Like when I was in Cleveland, there was a resident company there from Actors from New York or wherever. They'd be there all year, and you'd have a lead role one night, and you'd play a small role in Mice and Men the next night. But those theaters didn't exist anymore, and it was all being jobbed in play by play, and we weren't prepared for that. But yeah, so I think it was that, like, you have to be incredibly versatile. But some actor, like, somebody like George Clooney.
Yeah.
No, he's not incredibly versatile, but he transforms his soul into every role. And he, so there's the one that they should have, I just wish they stood back. Because again, I've seen that horrific damage done to young people. That this is their only life, and you really damage them. And that's just...
It's a dangerous game to play with kids.
Yeah. And I never, like, a lot of, I'm the only one, I think, from my class that's still an actor. There's one, one Lipper in Chicago, still an actor. And I guess there's another woman, or she's in Chapel Hill, Kathy Hutter, who acts and teaches. So there's three of us. But very early on, a lot of people just didn't do it. They got out, and they don't think they were really prepared. You know, going back to what you said, I think they should have been nurtured, not coddled.
Right, that's not the same thing.
Let's strengthen you finally. Like, okay, maybe
that is the word.
You're not a classical actor, but God damn, you can do Sam Shepard. You can fucking get. So let's know that that's your strength when you go to New York or LA or Milwaukee. No, let's nurture what you're good at instead of, well, you're not good at all these things, so sorry.
And I think this is the thing that I think that separates that, right? I used to, for years after I graduated, defend the classical approach to education in arts.
Yeah.
Whatever it happens to be. Not as if you shouldn't also take a modern class if you're a ballet dancer, or you shouldn't also take a musical theater class if you're an opera singer. I'm not against that, but you're knowing that that's kind of like a out of the wheelhouse. Let me stretch so that I can then service the main thing.
Yeah.
And I think that my attitude has shifted on that, because I think what I loved about the classical training that I'd never had before was really just the volume and the specificity. It wasn't the rigidity of it that I was in love with. It wasn't that it was some old program that Laurence Olivier took and now I'm taking the same thing. It wasn't about, I didn't care about the name Meisner. I didn't care about I just teach me how to be better at all this stuff. That's all I care about. And the state schools that some of my high school friends went to, or the even the acting like programs that they would join, it felt like unfocused, all over the place. Learn a little of this, learn a little bit of that. Yeah. And by the time you leave, you're a jack of all trades, a master of none. And I wanted the focus. I want to talk about acting and directing every day for 12 hours. And that's what I loved about the classical thing. But now my brain, after all these conversations, is reimagining a program, a way of teaching this that says we are going to work at that volume for people who are a little bit older, 20. We're going to work at that volume, but we are going to do exactly what you just said. I love that you used the word. We are going to play to your strengths.
Yeah.
We are going to identify and cast you into our company or troupe or whatever we're doing and say, man, he might be one of the greatest clowns we've ever met. It doesn't mean I'm not going to make him do Death of a Salesman to learn.
But
I'm not going to let the kid get twisted about thinking like I'm supposed to be as good as that as I am at doing stand-up comedy. It's you're not helping that artist grow when you say you need to get an A in every class.
And use those, like, I remember when we worked, we had, you know, the period where I worked on Shakespeare, and I remember thinking we went in, so like you said, incredible focus in learning and iambic pentameter, and I remember thinking, my God, because of that concentration, it certainly made anything else after that easy, because of that kind of analysis. The thing, and again, what I got from that school was discipline, because I didn't really have that discipline before.
Same.
It taught you to do more than is asked to, because anything after that felt easy. Because I remember when I had directors after that would sort of be tough and be like, I've seen so much tougher than you. It's like we had you may have heard of him. His name was Tunç Yalman, this Turkish director. He was ruthless, but one thing I liked about, first of all, he liked me for some reason. But he was cruel. And one thing was not because he was cruel to women, which at the time I didn't know.
Because you
But
didn't experience it directly. That
no,
happens to
but he was
us.
thinking, like, if you were late, if you came in 5 minutes late, he goes, "Baby, you are 5 minutes late. You have stolen 5 minutes from my life. How will you ever pay me back?"
Right.
And he was just, and my when we were in senior year, they
I
had
like
these things
that.
called these what was it, the TCA TCG auditions, where you'd go, they had them in Atlanta, all places. You'd have two monologues, a classical and a modern, and you'd go and do them for like a conference of regional theaters.
Right.
And you're supposed to pick, and it was me and three other actors. They had like four from the class, and I got picked, but you just chose a faculty member who would be your coach. So I
Got it.
chose Tunç because I knew he would be honest. So we sat down. He always had a cigarette, and he watched me do my two monologues, and he just sat there and went, "Well, maybe if I had, did not know you, Steve, and I was watching this, my opinion would be, well, he has no talent. He has been training for 4 years, and he has no voice. He has no sense of text." He goes, and I was like, "But it was like he was kind of right that way I did the law. I just wasn't very good at the time, and then he helped
Right.
getting." But
And to be
it's
clear, if that quote is accurate, which I am sure that it
yeah.
is, he did not say you don't. He said, if I
No.
was watching this objectively with no context, you did not show me all the stuff that you
But he also
learned.
reminded me, he said, "I know how good you can be. You did not show me that right now. Let's
Right.
find that again." Which again, I wish they could stand back and, like you said, some of them, "Oh yeah, and you really sucked at Death of a Salesman, but thank God you kill it in Restoration or whatever."
Right.
And it's they could have not damaged, because again, one thing I did is I think part of it, because I don't know if I just had a sense of self because of some of the stuff I've been through, of like, and I was competitive, not with the other people.
With
I was
yourself.
like, I want to, like, I'm gonna, like, I almost didn't come back my senior year because they kicked my girlfriend out.
Right.
And I was doing a job in Cleveland at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival, and I thought I could become equity, da, 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 and they wrote me a letter. And I remember because of the league auditions, which they call showcase now, I went, "I'm going back. I'm gonna fucking nail those auditions."
Yeah.
And I sort of went back with a vid, and I think that kind of, there was an anger and a kind of an ambition that got me through that. One thing I did not get a lot of, this just being specific to my experience, I didn't get a
Yeah.
lot of acting training. And it was interesting because what I learned the most when we'd have a guest director and they just treated you like a professional. And
Right.
again, you had to go back to your talent. But then they gave you some text analysis and stuff. We did have a pretty good text analysis class, but I learned most of the stuff once I got out on jobs. But they did, but again, but what I did get more than anything was the discipline. And because they didn't break me.
Right.
And that's something that has just been in my bones since then. Now, because I learned how to work, and I knew how. I remember, where the second year, you're like, "I'm going to prepare a monologue. I have to prepare this mind presentation. I also have a final exam in philosophy." And you said there aren't enough hours. Now I know why people have never straight it. But once you make it through
Right.
that, and it's not. It's not like the belt, but if you can make, I remember thinking, if I can make it through that, I can make it through anything. And nothing has ever been as hard as that.
Right.
And so.
I don't have a lot of opportunities to ask this question, so I'm going to take it. Tell me about the experience of your kid going there, man.
That was odd. That was
From a
very,
fridge, just
very.
like maybe a little bit of how it got there and then what it was like for her to be there coming home in the winter and shit.
I never thought she wanted to be an actor. I mean, it's funny because Emma, our favorite thing is, I mean, I should have seen it coming, but our favorite thing to do is a little, as from the time she was three, was play pretend and play old fashioned. She was always on the pretending to be on the phone. I don't know, I don't know if I told this story when we talked before, but it's such a great lesson in acting
Yeah,
that too.
please.
She always like she called she talked like we had this neighbor called Lori. She pretends she go hi Lori. She pretends she was on the phone. She had a little talk for go hi Lori. Yeah, And I always thought, God, it really sounds like she's on the phone. And then we'd be in the, we had a minivan, and she'd be in her little car seat when she was like 5 or 4. Well, I guess 4, not 5. And she'd be on the phone going, yeah, I'm talking. Blah, blah, blah.
So
And it's
busy, always so busy.
yes. And I was, and she had a little friend that was like a real athlete, and the little girl didn't want to play pretend. And Emma was like, what is wrong with you?
Right.
And the one time, this is a great acting lesson. I was teaching a class. This was, Emma was about, probably about 4. I was teaching this class, and there's this woman, she had a scene where she was on the telephone, and she had written out what the other person was saying in this, and it still just didn't sound, and I, you know, we, the way I worked the class is you do a scene 1 week, and then you do it again after notes the next week. And I was really kind of stumped, as I can't, this is a good actor, which just sounds just fake. And I was talking to Emma in the car, you know, in the week before the next class. And I said, Emma, you know, she'd been on the phone talking to some pretend person. And I said, Emma, in my class, there was this lady, well, she has a phone call and it just doesn't sound real. And Emma said, why doesn't she just pretend she's on the phone? And I went, so the next class, she did it, and it started off the same way. And I go, why don't you just pretend you're talking to them? And the actor went, okay. And she nailed it. And it reminded, because again, one thing I was doing as a director or teacher was over, I was already giving notes like, why this and imagine this, instead of, well, what about that pretend thing that you have? Because one thing I said about what I would tell actors, again, at the beginning of a rehearsal for a play or in a class, is like, you're good at this. I said, actors, we're not better than other people, but what we are better at is playing pretend. We just, we can learn a lot. We have a facility, you know. And people, you know, I know actors that say, oh, people always say, how did you learn all those lines? And I was like, yeah, that's a really, I remember I did this one-man play, and I had to learn like 1.5 hours of dialogue. That's a huge accomplishment. Just learning lines for a play is not an easy thing to do. But also that skill to pretend you're somebody else, you kind of forget that that's not a natural thing that a lot of people
have. Right.
You know, they say, we're all actors. They're like, yeah, but you try doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Right.
But that was a really big lesson. But back to Emma. So she went, but she did not want to become an actor. I remember at one point, I think it was in the 90s, she was probably like 11. And she said, Daddy, I don't want to be an actor. It's too hard. Because she saw, like, Daddy's not working and who's paying the bills all that, you know. But then she did her babysitter was on Broadway in Les Miserables. And I took her to New York. We went to see her. And she was invited backstage and got to stand out on the Broadway stage. And I remember thinking then, oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh, shit.
and she was good at it. She did plays. And she directed in high school, too. She directed in Godspell, which is phenomenal.
We did talk about that on the last
one. And she was really good. And so, so when she went to the school, there's a natural thing of, as a parent, just being afraid for them. I was afraid she, you know, also I thought, what if she doesn't get in, you know? And then when she got
what
in,
what if she does and she thinks it's because of you?
Yeah. And so, and I knew that it's like, I thought, you know, it's they're just not, because they have like a couple thousand people audition, you know? And it was like, and I didn't know the faculty by then. I think I knew Molly Murray was still there. Bob Francesconi.
Yeah, Francesconi was still there, right.
But I thought that's, you know, that they just don't work their way. So it's not like Ohio State where it's like,
And even though Gerald at that point was essentially on his way out, but had built that school around his methodology for so long, but you weren't there at that time. You were there right before that.
And that's what she auditioned for, because he was just like, when we sat in, we went to audit some classes and then we sat in on a scene study that he was teaching. And I thought, oh my God, I wish he was staying, because he was so great.
Right. Wow.
And she got in, so it was a mixture of relief and then like, oh God, it's going to be hard. Like, I know they'd gotten kinder and gentler, but not that kind of gentler.
How did you approach keeping her from breaking the way that you did?
It's the same way I do now that she's in New York. Because I wish someone had told me to just stand back and keep a sense of humor about things.
Advice, dude.
And because I did. One thing, that friend of mine, Craig Sisler, the older guy, we became best friends. And that, you know, and I moved off campus as soon as I could. So that helped me keep her perspective too. I really did just keep your sense of humor about it. And I saw the pitfalls where I'd say you could only do, like when she'd say, I have 7 classes to do. So I said, you're not. I remember she even said this was, she said, thank you for telling me this. But I said, I remember trying, I wanted to excel at each thing. And I said, you're just not going to. You got to pick that one or two things that you really want to nail. And if it means, like, if you get a C on your whatever human emotion class, you know, your academic class.
Yeah.
This is just going to have to, and she's an A, she's really motivated in that. And I thought, you're going to have to let a couple things go, because otherwise they will all suffer. I think that's one of the most practical things for the school that I told her.
Do you always have that attitude with her as far as like giving her room to play to strengths? And then as a result, like, how did she have that diligence?
Part of it is in her, is I think part of it is she's a tough little kid, and she was, this is a story that I always remind her of. She was about three, and we went to this, we're in some park, and there was a play structure,
yeah,
and there was a little sort of little house thing, and she was playing Three Little Pigs with this other little boy who was just wandered in, and he went to go into her house, and she stuck her head out, and she went, and he burst into tears. Of course, I went, Emma, but inside I was like, it's my girl.
Nice.
So she has, and it's a weird, she has a kind of, she's like very sweet person.
Oh,
she's,
yeah.
She's fierce. And the person who chooses to direct Bent, a play of the Holocaust in Brooklyn in February, New York City, and then managed to sell it out for, 2 weeks.
And let's be honest, do it again.
Yeah,
she knew already what she was getting into, and she's like, I need more of this Holocaust in the wintertime.
Yeah, I don't know what she has to do. I remember thinking,
and I'll direct my dad. That'll be easy.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought, no one's going to come see this in February in Brooklyn. But they did, because of all the work she did, and it was really good. So she has that. But also, she has a scared part of her. And I thought, I could, because of the mistakes I never had someone say to me, just relax, take it easy. At one point, my dad, he called me. It was a Saturday night, my freshman year, and I was at hall in my room working. And he said, all work and no play makes a very dull boy. And so I went out that night and had fun.
And killed people at a hotel. I misunderstood.
I worked too hard at times. It was like, you got to let go. And I didn't have to tell me to do that. And that's what I tried to do throughout it. What was really hard was when the showcase came up, because I remember, when I did it, I did very well. I got a lot of interviews and stuff and da da da. But there were really good actors in my class, because again, acting is very subjective. They didn't get the right scenes or whatever, and they didn't get any calls. And Emma didn't get much of a response to the showcase. And that was really, boy, as a parent, it's like when your kid's playing Little League and they're
balls. They don't get picked, or they, yeah.
Ribs here, like if you become a D, I don't think you have kids.
I don't have
yet.
Children, no.
That's the, because your heart is really that also, it's outside of you, and you're like, the world's gonna hurt him. And that was very hard to like how to prepare for that, because it's like you don't know, and it's like, and because I remember some people did really well that never worked ever, and I did really well, but then I didn't work for a year and a half. I got to New York,
I did,
and nothing happened.
I do think that that's a thing that I wish you could find a way. But again, you're so young at 22. How do you tell a 22-year-old, this thing is one of the biggest opportunities you've ever had, but don't put all your eggs in one bag? Like, how do you do both things? You can't.
That's
so
impossible.
Hard.
It's
but
just,
what I can, I can point people to, and this is what I tell anyone who's ever at school that I talk to that has it coming up. I just went to the drama showcase, like a little mixer thing that was out here when they came to L.A.
Yeah.
And kind of talking to some of the students, and it's like anytime you try to tell someone who is too young for an experience to be processed in their brain, you can't push that in before it's ready to be there. But the thing I wish I could give everybody, when I oh my god, I'm holding the pen, that's funny, it'll be a good prop in a second. I started doing stand-up comedy when I moved to LA in a more serious way. I was going to go all the time. I was doing open mics. I was trying to get booked on stuff. And I spent about 2 years like really hitting the pavement trying to be a stand-up. And I got booked really early when I was knew nothing about what I was trying to do in a comedy contest at Flappers in Burbank. And I was like, oh shit, I got booked on a contest. Okay, well, this will tell me something. And then I find out, of course, it's one of those like bringer things where if whoever brings more people who essentially then vote for them, that's who wins. But every now and then there's a judge and you might get some feedback. I ended up going through like four levels of this bracket
I
thing, and I went to like the finals in December. And it was like supposed to be like, we did so many rounds of this. There's like over 300 comedians. These are the best nine of the season or whatever. But yeah, in my head, I was saying all of the wows that you were saying, Steve. And I got up to the show, and one of my buddies, who is also on the lineup, who I like kind of coming up with at the time, totally rigged the whole thing. He's a genius. He's like 10 years younger than me, and he's blowing up. He's always blowing up on social media because he like understands things on a level that I can't function.
Really?
He bought half the house, and then he sold the
Oh
tickets
man.
to his friends and family who live locally. He's from around
Yeah.
here, at half price. But you won 2 grand if you won. So he got all his money back.
Oh wow.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Deserved to win. And funny. Didn't cheat. Funny guy. So, but he totally stole it. And I remember when the host got up for the night, and in my head, I'm nervous. The other rounds, I was like, whatever. But I was like, there's a trophy. I mean, how
Yeah,
am I not
no.
fucking nervous? Come on. And my grandfather had just passed away, and I had rewritten my whole set to be this kind of like total theater. It was a terrible decision. I should have just done my fucking jokes. But point being, the host gets up for the night to introduce the whole thing. And he goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to whatever Uncle Clyde's comedy con, whatever it's called. Welcome, welcome." Everyone's like, "Ah, we got nine comedians for you, best of the 300, whatever." Ah. And he goes, "And of course, you all know the previous winners." And he names off like the last seven people, and no one's ever fucking heard of any of these people. And he goes, "Anyway, all right, let's get started." Like, he
Wow.
set the tone for the thing of like, this is fun and we're gonna give a trophy and this is all good and fun, but like, that
This was
we're not a star maker. This isn't Johnny Carson's couch. Don't get
never
it
read there.
twisted. And it hit me really hard in that moment before I even went on stage of
But
like, oh, I have done way too much work in my own head about this. This should
really.
just be another stand-up set. I should just treat it like everything else. And if anyone ever even remembers it in fucking January, I'll be like, yeah, that's what
Wait,
it deserves. It
wait.
also could have been a thing that like there might have been a manager, an agent that saw me that night. And it could, yes, that could have
Then,
literally
yeah.
been possible. But to temper those expectations to say, doing the work is the thing I was taught to respect.
And enjoy it. Have
Yeah, it's supposed
fun.
to be fucking fun. This is in
Yeah, that's
comedy.
another thing. That's another thing I tried to get to Emma, which is like, this is. If you, because I remember I was so bad, even when I got my first, like I got my first theater job was at the Guthrie, and I was so miserable because I was so terrified because we're control hard,
Yeah.
like, and I wish somebody said, no, you're supposed to have fun, and that, yeah, exactly. It's like it's not corny to say no. It's the joy of doing even auditions too. Like
Yeah.
my wife makes fun of me because I have fun at
Yeah.
audition. I don't have fun. Like I actually just this afternoon I auditioned for a play for the first time. Last play I did was Bed in
Was
New York.
Ben. Yeah, okay.
And my goal was I want to enjoy myself. Now, but to enjoy myself, I have to work my ass off. Like, I didn't want to go in holding paper. I mean, I had the paper. I didn't want to look at it because I wanted to be this guy for that whatever 10 minutes I was in there. I wanted to enjoy it and get to do that because I like playing pretend. And I had to learn that though, because it was
Right.
always. Because especially like if you're so miserable, I remember thinking, my God, I'm so miserable not working. And when I get a job, I'm miserable too.
Cool,
And
man.
that's like, yeah, you could have, because again, also too, on a practical level, like
Right.
you said, what you learned about it, like if I enjoyed it, if I didn't put such big stakes on it, and you can know, okay, you can know the stakes are there. But, and even, it's funny, but at the showcase, luckily, I went the night before, there's this friend of mine who had been to school before. We went out and had some drinks. And I wasn't worried about the thing, and everyone else was just, oh, going over the lines. And the next day, I went in having fun,
Yeah.
and I think that's one of the reasons I remember going in because I remember the scenes before me. Everyone seemed kind of tense, and I was like, "I got this. I done the work." It wasn't arrogance, but also this friend helped me think of other things. And I went in going, "This is what I love these scenes," and I had a hell of a fun time doing it. And like, yeah, if you go up stand up, and it's like if you're thinking, it's gotta mean something. You're gonna do that, and then,
You
but
can
if you're
hear
happy,
the comedy in that setup.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
It's
yeah, that and that's
ridiculous.
nothing. There should be a person on staff at every conservatory that is just the person that comes around and goes, don't forget, this is supposed to be fun. You chose this to not go and study accounting or art history because you love this. You
Yeah.
love print. And I remember thinking, there's movies I get to do now. Like, we're doing, I remember one of the Andre movies, we're like running through this mist. We're grown-ups. Like, I was 50 something at the time. Patrick Wilson is like, a
Right.
little young. And we're like, they went cut, and we looked at each other. It was like, can you believe we're grown-ups and we get to do this?
Yes. And
And
those
it's like,
sets feel different when
yeah, and
everyone's
it,
there.
well, it's just, and it's just silly. And even when you think about, oh, Daniel Day-Lewis and in Last of the Mohicans, he still dressed up like an Indian and run around like I did when I was 11.
Right.
And but that's, I think that's part of it. That's the joy you get. Yeah, and you do all the preparation and you live in, and I've done this stuff where I immersed. I mean, when I did Bend, I dug into all the research and the thing and how people stood and posture and this and
Hell of a
dispersion. Well,
mustache.
literally, hell of a mustache. But also, it's like, but behind it all is like, I get to be somebody I'm
Yeah.
not, and I get to sort of play Nazi war scary thing. But there should be, that should be a constant reminder to have fun, because when you have fun, you get a confidence. Like,
Right.
nothing like that feeling of love. I can't wait to go in there and do this. Whether it's you're about to go on stage, or you're about to shoot, or you're about to do an audition,
Right.
versus like, oh, I got to get this. And then there, again, there are auditions where, you go, I got it.
Sure.
But I think that sense of fun is so contagious. I
It's a
know you.
hard argument when you're young, and I think it's like you said, it's one of those things that you kind of have to soak in it to really let yourself be reminded of that after losses and successes and both. And like, it kind of wears on you. I remember I saw an interview recently. I saw the clip, but it wasn't a recent interview with Michael Keaton. And he was saying, he kind of almost exactly what you just said, dude, of like, I spent years being miserable, especially in auditions, until
Yeah.
they handed me the contract and I signed it and I knew I was going to have money. I was like, ah, this is terrible. I hate this. And he goes, and
Feeling
then one day I realized the audition is the work too.
Yeah.
Both. It's both. The gig is the work, but the audition is the work. And so when I started realizing that every time I go to audition and I have to, drive to the valley or do the whatever the thing is, and I'm on the way and I'm going through the rigmarole or I'm making the tape, I'm thinking, I'm going to work. This is the
Yeah.
work. This is the thing I learned how to do. This is the thing I said to myself I want to do. So I just go to
Yeah.
work. And when you do that, the freedom it gives you
Yeah.
as an artist to say, like, I'm
Fun.
always working, and it's it, what a blessing. The gratitude washes over
And you
you.
get, and I try to, it sounds very corny, what I try to do is I get to play, like, even this audition today, which is the first time I've been in a room with that, because it's, you're always
It's
tape,
all
even
self-tape
theater.
these days, yeah.
And I went in, I got to see this. There's an actor in Titles there before me. And I was like, but I love that old competition. I was like, oh, yeah, well, I got to do. And it's fun. It's just like, and I went in and it's like, and I left going, I did what I wanted. And I got to surprise myself, and I got to be the guy. Even if I don't play
Yeah.
this role, it
Yeah.
actually would be inconvenient, because it's like, it's a play. If I do it, it's like, all right, I'm going to go broke for, a couple of months. And, but it's like, but I got to have fun. And it's like, but again, in order to do that, but for me, and maybe it's a work ethic thing too, I have to get to that place where it's not, I'm not thinking of the lines, I'm not, where I get to sort of, I can do stuff that I didn't think about, like, so stuff will come out where it's that part of you that's like that, the talent part, it's, that's like
Because
a,
you want to do the work before you get the job because the work is fun.
And I have pride. Like, I want this. I want to go in there going, that's the best I
Right,
can.
right.
And it's, and that's not like, especially thing, because I, it was filled with audition board stuff where it's like, sometimes now I'm a little lucky that I can go, I don't want to do that. Like, in the role recently, where my manager was like, you got to read for this. And I was like, I played that part. I don't
Right.
want to do that. What just, I can imagine being there. I don't, I'm 63 now, and there's less time in front of me than there was behind me. I don't want to waste my time. It's like, I want to do stuff that is challenging or fun, or getting to work with a director I, really wanted to work with. And it's,
Right.
we didn't have that. I'm very grateful I have a little bit of that luxury. where I can be a little choosier.
Sure.
But again, it's just like, did I tell you the analogy? If I'll start to say it, I was doing a play in New York, and that was 1984, and it was great part, great little play, but I was working too hard, and my acting teacher from North Carolina happened to be in New York, came to see the performance, the play. And he came backstage, he goes, "Steve, that was good, but you're shitting grapefruits." And
no, I didn't. I do not. I would remember the story.
You remember that?
I don't recall.
And
go
it was
on.
True. I was working so hard. I was shitting basketballs because it's really, really. It was just such a great role, and I wasn't having any fun. He said that, and that really changed. It was really a big turning point in my acting. Because it's true, I was working so, and when I look back at the rehearsal process, because part of it too was 24, and it's like everything had, I gotta get really successful. I mean, New York,
right? Of course, you're in a hurry.
Gotta get the better at this. Instead of like, you know, this great, you know, it was play. Angus McLaughlin wrote the play, and it was great. And so, I've told that a lot when I've been directing and stuff. I said, "You're shitting grapefruits," and I tell that story.
Yeah. I'm gonna steal it.
Yeah, I do.
Great line.
You can work too hard at anything. I remember we did Diary of Anne Frank, and I remember sitting on the stairs, and I'd be thinking of the Holocaust. And this, and then I forgot, wait a minute, and I learned this. Emma did this for Ben. She goes, "They don't know there's a Holocaust. It's not the Holocaust."
Right. Yeah,
they
she
just
said that on her episode.
Work him, and they're going to get out. They're going to get out.
Yeah, once this whole thing blows over.
They don't know 6 million, 20 million people eventually. Well, you know.
Right.
They don't know that. They just think this is terrible. We got to get out. If we do the right thing, we'll get out. It's, you know.
Yeah.
And that was another. I was shooting grapefruits and that until I had a director too that went, "And you let him up. You're just a kid. You're 15 in this. You don't know. You're in love with this girl. It's kind of cool. You're in this attic. You don't know that they're taking over the world. You know."
Right.
So that's don't shoot grapefruits. That's what
that's good advice. I have just a couple. How much time do you have? I don't want to take up too much.
I'm just now
wonderful. I got two quick things. Yeah. I always tell people I don't like to read them their resumes, and I'm not going to. But you teased something to me the last time we talked that I want to bring up, and then so I'll start with that, which is Time to Kill.
Oh my God!
I just happened to mention the title in a list of like, hey, one day maybe we'll talk about this. Anyway, let's get to Bent, and you said to me, I got a great Time to Kill story. And I was like, I can't wait. And that was like 3 years ago. So I'm very patient.
Not the Time to Kill story? Okay.
If you can, I would love it. I love that movie.
You may want to edit this out or whatever, but because, I'll try to make it a little shorter. Okay, it came about, it's like, Emma was about 4. So that's about 94.
That would have been 99. Yeah, she's 92?
No. So it would have been... Like, yeah, so she was little. She was a baby. Maybe so it was about, she was born in 93, so maybe about 95
or so. That sounds right.
So she's a baby. I had a stepson, I still do. He was about 11. And it was a point where I think I'd done a lot of just little bit parts, like playing deputies here, a couple lines, paramedic number 2.
Sure.
Also, you know, just, and it was a little bit, it's an analogy I've used about, you know, Charlie Brown in the football. It's like, I'm nothing about Lucy. He says, no, this time, really, we're not going to. And I was in that kind of stage. I was just like, it wasn't really working. And it was, and I put baby at home, and it was just really tough. And then Joel Schumacher, who at the time was huge, he was touring the country on a press thing for Batman, or Batman Forever, whatever.
Big, yeah, Val Kilmer.
And you know, coming through time, but he's also auditioning for A Time to Kill, which had been this huge bestseller. Sandra Bullock was this huge star. She's going to do it.
John Grisham, right?
John Grisham. So they come, and the way is the casting director is seeing people on a Saturday, just a general interview. So we made this wonderful woman, I can't remember her name, British. And she said, oh, you would be really good for this role of Mickey Mouse. It's this role in the film that he's an undercover FBI guy. He saves Sandra Bullock's life, but then they find out he's an informant and they burn him alive. So come back tomorrow and we'll read for that. So I go home, I buy the book, I read it. It's a really cool part. I was like, oh my God, this is great. And I read
the novel that evening?
Yeah.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
Jesus, yeah, just, Steve, you kind of breeze past that. Like, that's a thing a lot of people do is read John Grisham book in a night.
School of the arts.
It's man.
Like, you go, they taught you that, well, if it's a positive sign, you can do anything. You
write
can
it
do
down, kids. Write it down.
Stay at all night and write a book. So it got me really introduced. I go in and read Roll. It goes very well. She goes, okay, I want you. You're going to meet Joel. He'll be in town in a couple of days. So a couple days goodbye. I memorize the scene, about two, three scenes to read for. And I go in, and my memory of it was that it was at the Four Seasons Hotel, which normally, you know, these auditions, you go for some TV movie, be it like a Holiday Inn.
So they shoot that in Louisiana?
They shot it in Mississippi. Oh, okay. We'll get to
got it.
So this is around June, I think. And so, so again, it's like Charlie Brown was like, come on out. So I didn't want to, like, okay. And then I'll come and read with you. And then you're going to meet the director. So I was like, okay, I'll come. I'll kick your football. So I go in, and it's in a suite. So they have this little lounge area and they haven't called in anyone else for my role. There's like six actors, all for different roles. And I went, wow, that's pretty good. I go in, and it's Joel Schumacher and the producer, just two people. And they're very friendly. And I do the audition, and then there's this pause. And that is, they couldn't have written more complimentary things, just being very specific. How are you? Why don't we know about you? This kind of stuff. And I almost cried because it was a very hard time. New dad, you know, not thinking. And again, also because I moved from New York, Orlando, and part of that at the time, I felt like I gave up. I remember thinking, you're a real actor. You're in New York City, you're in Los Angeles. And I remember thinking, people have said, well, I guess Steve Coulter gave up, you know, and I was doing some plays and stuff. But here I felt like I'm going to be redeemed. And they said, you are wonderful. You brought a face to the character we didn't even see there. It couldn't have, it was ridiculous.
Your first nailed audition of that level, in your mind.
Yeah. It was like, and I'd done theater. Like, I remember my Guthrie theater audition. I kind of nailed that because I wrote a song for it.
Shit.
Yeah. I'm highly motivated.
Yeah. So and I left talented and humble, it seems.
Well, I left it. A week later, my agent calls and says, Warner Brothers call. They're very interested in you for this role. I mean, they weren't putting me on hold or anything. And again, in the hindsight, it's like they would have been more specific. So back then, there wasn't a lot of trades. There's nothing online or stuff. But I remember reading some announcements saying, well, they've cast so-and-so and so-and-so. Then a month went by. Then it was August. And then the casting director of the agent said, well, no, they're still very interested in you. I said, for that role, they go, we think so. And then they said they're going to start shooting in Mississippi in September. Or September, I think. And then it was like a couple of weeks before September. They said, well, you're not up for that role anymore. But they really like you. And I'm like, okay. So I'm still like holding on, like, okay.
Like it to be their friend or what?
So then they go, you're going to be, they've cast you, you're playing the Klansman. And I'm like, okay. Yeah, the Klansman. So they send me a script, the whole script.
Not A, but, the.
Yeah. And I look through the script, read it thoroughly. There's no the Klansman. Now there's a big scene, there's a big, long 10-page scene. There's this big, you know, they have this big rally where there's the black population of whatever, and then you have these Klansmen come, and then there's a riot and firebombing and this, and I went, I guess it's somewhere in there. So I'd be like, now I'm back to being Charlie Brown. I'm like, okay, a role that doesn't have any lines, and then and then they're paying me more than I've ever been paid, double skip, you know, and I'm like, wow, they say, do you want to fly? Or they'll just give you the equivalent of money to drive. And I went, I'll take the money. I got a 2-year-old there. So I drive to Mississippi. I forgot how many states there are. I thought there was less. I forgot there's Alabama.
The hell is Alabama?
I got through Alabama.
No, it's like, Alabama and then Mississippi.
Is it?
Okay. And then Louisiana, then Texas. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So thank you.
I got you.
They put me up in this suite. I'm like, okay. So now I'm getting...
of the Klansmen down here.
It's like, and I was like, well, maybe this is more than I thought. And as it's sort of called it the next morning, I'm going in, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning. I get in the van,
and you don't know what you're doing.
Don't know what I'm doing at the Klansmen. Yeah, I'm still like, so I get in this van with the costume designer of, you know, it's Joel Schumacher, since I work with him on Batman and all these things.
Yeah.
Playing, and I said, This is kind of weird, but I really don't. It's called the Klansman. She goes, oh, don't worry. On every film, yeah, here goes the football again. Joel, like one actor that he finds a place for that he really believes in. So I'm like, okay, I'm great. I'm but going to makeup and they get me all sweaty. I have my little Klansman's outfit. And again, they just, and I have a lot. And look, I'm all set. And then we go to the town square. It's still dark. It's very early. And the holding place is this little chapel, I guess my memory of it. And I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting next to this young African-American woman who plays, there's someone who sings a solo at the rally. Her name's Buttercup, I think. So we're sitting, tiling, and waiting. And finally, Joel Schumacher walks in with all these people behind him. And he looks over to me and Buttercup, and he goes, and I was like, oh my God, yes. And I went like that. And he went, Buttercup. And I'm like, okay, let me. And then so he's giving Buttercup this big hug, and I'm standing waiting for my hug.
Dressed like a Klansman.
Yeah, just I have my little Klansman outfit. Don't have that on. And then he looks at me like I am garbage. And he goes, who are you? And I said, I'm the Klansman. And he goes, I got a lot of Klansmen, and walks off. And I'm like, okay. So it was all downhill after that. I was there for about 9 days, I think. Maybe probably less. It seemed longer. And basically, no lines, really. I am in with like maybe 100 other Klansmen, these guys from Mississippi, probably some of them were Klansmen. And all they did was hate me because it would be lunch. And they go, break, Steve, come, lunch. And they're like, who the fuck is this? He's doing what we're doing. He gets treated like this. And I was just invisible. It's that thing of like, boy, if I have a Achilles heel, it's feeling invisible. Mm. And it was getting paid a lot, but it was like, and there's only, and no one, and here's, I'm sitting, you know, I'm hanging, this like Donald Sutherland and
right.
Matthew McConaughey, I'm watching this guy, his first real big part.
Yeah, baby boy Matthew
big
McConaughey.
Adored and everything. He's like, he's getting his big break. Sandra Bullock's there.
Sam Jackson.
And no one's talking to me because it's like, why are you here? They are looking at me, right. Like, why are you here with the main cast? And I don't want to go, well, actually, I didn't want to tell them the 20-minute story I just did.
Right.
There's only one person who was the props woman. She came over to me and she went, this must be awful.
And you're like, you're my favorite person on set.
Yeah, she said, you've got this part, but you're not getting to do what you love to do. You're getting paid, but you're not. And then I never forget, there was like a Dan Rather from CBS News was there. And I remember I heard this voice and he was doing a report and I was on that. They could see me there. I was on this news thing longer than that. Like, I don't think I ever saw the movie because I'm wearing a Klansman's outfit. And then another thing, I got really bad sunburn and I was just.
Despite the hood.
And I remember, and it was just so, and I actually finally went to Joel Schumacher. I caught him like the day before I was leaving. I said, maybe a little before.
Listen,
said,
you.
What? I said, I'm not sure what I'm doing. I said, I'm not sure why I'm here. Oh, no, I guess it wasn't Joel. It was that producer. It was very nice. He goes,
right.
He goes, well, Joel does. He usually finds an actor like that woman and says,
yeah.
And he tries to find a way. And he goes, I'm sorry. I guess he never really, it got off his radar.
I think that is absolutely wild. My immediate response to that, other than I love your sense of humor in telling that story, because I mean it wasn't yesterday, so there's a lot of perspective there. That is a tough roller coaster to be on. Well, that's my first thing.
Yeah.
My second thing is just as a producer of TV shows now, and someone who, you know, starts to think about budgets in a way I never did when I was in the theater. How does a suite and double scale get wasted and fall between the and let's just put on the back burner the talent we're wasting in this relationship, because now this guy, it's like, would he ever even come to a Joel Schumacher set again after this? Is like, he's been Charlie Brown. But put that aside and just talk about the money. These movies with budgets. I'm like, and the
TV
director doesn't even know who he is.
Yeah. We would never. When I wrote for Tyler Perry, we had to make sure it. You know, if this guy has one line, it's got to be worth it.
We're gonna have to pay him way more.
Fine, and we're done. Yeah, and the thing is, when I drove back to Atlanta, I lived they sobbed in the car.
Of course,
so I just but... thought because I felt like I'd find a little bit. And I remember there's a song by Mary Chapin Carpenter called Jubilee, which and I put it. I just happened to have that in a cassette, and that song came on. That's what made me cry because it's all about, you know, comeback. It's I know it's so hard, but come back. There are people that love you in this. And but it was really work because it was just like I remember thinking I can't do this anymore. I just
what restored
can't.
You after that professionally?
Boy, you know, I don't know. I really I just somehow I wish I, I'll think about that.
Sure, sure.
Because I don't, you know, it's and then because and it's funny because I have a friend of mine. He's writing a book called Tales from the Hunting Wagon. Because a lot of actors have stories like that where. You know, his story was that he kept getting this.
And they die on the vine. I mean, those stories, especially now with stuff like NDAs and stuff, you may not even be able to tell stories like that about certain things.
Yeah. Well, he did, like this guy, he got cast in this Tom Cruise movie in a really good role, would have been worked for like 3 weeks. And then they rewrote it, wrote his character out. Then they wrote him back in, then they wrote it out. Then he got a role for a day. And then Tom Cruise bulldozed over all his lines. And then he finally got to say one line. And then they cut it from the final film. And a lot of, and I've been cut out of movies. I've gone to a premiere of a movie that I thought I was in, and then the scene, you go, oh wait, the plot just the plot just took it. It wasn't in the script I read. And then you go, oh well, if this happened, my character's scene isn't necessary. No, it's not necessary,
and it's not there.
But that was the worst. And I just, I guess part of it is, I guess I am. I've always been very ambitious, and I always felt like, and this, it's the only thing I know how to do, really. I almost, you know, I've worked for a while in the night. At the time, I was working a lot with addicts and kids in prison and doing acting and teaching them how to tell stories with that and tell their stories. I think that helped a little bit to just, I don't know, keep me out of the earth and focus. And I did start actually working more consistently. And that's, I started making a living. I was sort of making a living acting. I had to teach too. But I was like, but then I started making a little, it just sort of, when I came very, very close, like if there had been an opportunity, like to teach full time or something, I think I would
someone
have
handed
it.
You a nice ticket, you would have taken it at many
points. Yeah, I think because after that, it was like, fuck this. And it was just so, and even now when I hear, I did a role in a film and the guy said, I could have modeled this on Joel Schumacher. I told him the story. He goes, maybe you shouldn't think about that. And it's like, but, you know, and again, it's just, it's part of, you know, if it, stuff like that, going back to the school, if stuff doesn't break you, well, it does give you a humility.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you spot those other people that have had that, the fellow travelers, and like, I think, you know, you've been hurt. You can spot the people that have been hurt. I don't mean that you look damaged.
No, I take it as a compliment.
But it's kindred souls. And then when you meet people, it's like, it's a way, it is. One of the rewards was like, I was shooting a, I'm going to drop names. I was doing a Robert De Niro movie in New York. And I was doing the scene where we do a cab, you know, pulling up and get out of the car. And a Teamster was, he had to back up the cab each time. And this guy named Joey, he was real New York Teamster.
Hell yeah.
It's and I'd been working, people. Working for about, and then I'm working for about 2 weeks on it. And he goes, he looked at me and went, you know, Steve, you've paid your dues. I can tell that. And I went, yeah, I can just tell the way you treat everybody, you've paid your dues. And it's experiences like that. I don't wish it on anybody because it can, like I said, it really, it kind of just fucking shut. Because I thought, this is my big break. This is the break. And it not only was it not, it was at all. And then as the embarrassment of like, the movie's coming out. You're like, oh, I hear you're in that. And you're like, and then people are like, I saw it. I didn't see you. I saw you in the credits.
Like I was in the body bag in Act Two that goes off.
And it's like, yeah, so it's not really a sort. Now I can laugh at it. But yeah, at the time, it's just the worst thing. And you just think, I've made a mistake. At the time, how old was I? I think I was 34, 36 or so.
Yeah.
Thinking, I'm fucked. That's like, that was it. Because also I was living in Atlanta and opportunities like that, we were getting TV movies two or three times a year. And then,
was
like I said,
anything like it is now?
Nothing. No, not. And then, and you had to go to Wilmington to go play a cop for a day.
Right, on
And
Dawson's Creek or whatever
so
it
I
was.
thought this was my chance, and
Yeah.
it's caught. And when's that gonna happen again?
Right.
So,
All the
but
movies they shoot in Mississippi. All right, well that's that leads me to my very last thing. I did this is a, this is a kind of a double-edged sword for me because I'm a big fan of you, man. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I'm a big fan of you just as a person, but the problem is it's hard to be a big fan of you as an actor because you do a lot of scary shit and I don't watch that stuff.
neither do I. I don't
And
like
so
scary
I
shit.
was get that was going to be my question. I'm looking at this list and I just kind of glance at the hits here. And I remember seeing you on Walking Dead because I had a girlfriend who was into that show. So I started watching the zombie shit, even though it wasn't my thing. And I ended up getting deep into like, oh, I think I watched through like seven or something. So I saw I've seen that. And but I was looking at this list just kind of at a glance, like, oh, okay, cool. And but I'm like, Conjuring, Annabelle. I'm like, man, I can't. When am I going to get to see this guy I like do some acting? Because I'm not watching this shit.
Took
It
out the rest of it.
terrifies me.
Yeah, and I stopped because, well, what happened is
How did
because
you end up in all that stuff?
James Wan, because I did one scene in the first Conjuring, Michonne
Okay.
Williams
Got it.
scene. I don't think it was extraordinary. Just did my job. It was one little scene. Then a year later, he calls me up or sent an email or something saying he's wants you to do this, like a big role in the Insidious 2. There's, and then after that, he put me in Insidious 3. He put me in one of the, he did the Furious 7, I think it was.
Okay.
But man, that he's just very loyal. And I never intended to do, and I've actually stopped, well, except for, I'll tell you one exception I made. I kind of stopped doing horror. The trouble is, the ones I've done are these huge hits.
Yeah.
Like, well, what's really great about that is residual. My
Of
God.
course, of course.
Very
And
adamant about
horror
that.
gets watched at home.
They're so loyal. And then horror fans,
Yeah.
it was like I scary movies. Like I've never watched The Ring or because they scare me too much.
Yeah,
I'm
I'm
just
totally. My thing is, I
yeah.
don't have a problem with gore or even psychological
Me
stuff.
either. The
It's
evil
the
stuff.
evil stuff and the startling. Stop
Yeah.
jumping out at me. I'll watch
Yeah.
Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs back to back. I like those
Yeah.
kinds of movies, but man.
Yeah, I haven't done, and
Oof.
I did. I went back. The last thing I did as horror because they did the last Insidious movie because Patrick Wilson
Right.
directed it, and he called me and he said we want to bring back Carl because he was kind of fan little favorite in this little cameo,
And
and I was
probably
like,
likes you too. He's a theater guy.
great, and he's really like, yeah, and he's like a very courting. It's an he's an actor's actor, really
Right.
good director. First film he's directed, really good director. So
Awesome.
when he did that, but apart from that, I just like I get offered horror stuff. I just go, thank you, because
I
I
did my
have a.
time on that.
Well, I've done my time out, and I've had a friend of mine who she, that's all she does now. And she's so much better than that. She's like, but she's at an age now where it's like, hey, fuck it, it's great, great. And I just don't want to do that. But yeah, I've luckily done, like, check the rest of the resume. There's been a lot of other
Sure.
stuff that a couple, oh, I didn't, if I'm not edited out, met Oppenheimer in July. It's a
Oh
little,
shit, I did not know that. That is
well, I
exciting.
think
I'm
just for a
definitely going to
day,
see that.
because is Christopher Nolan is like, I don't care. I will literally serve in coffee. I think it's just one
Oh,
little
for
zip.
sure. I'm a huge fan.
But yeah, check the resume, kid. There's a lot out there.
Oh,
But
I'm
the
going to
horror
dive
again.
deep now that I know I like you, man. I only got to talk to you for like 20 minutes last time. I was on
No,
the
but
fence. I was like, I think he seems cool. I like the stash. I know his daughter, but we got to get into it sometime.
beautiful. Well, check out She-Hulk because that's a lot of
Yes,
fun.
I got to.
Really
I'm behind
fun.
on my Marvel series, but I'm actually kind of
That's
a
a
Marvel
problem. It's a
fanboy. I got
different
to
Marvel
see it.
series because it makes fun of the Marvel universe. It makes fun
Right.
of superheroes. And it
It's
got to
kind of
be
a
very different.
self-aware project.
Yeah. And it was weird that when you just see it, it's funny because I went there with the prim. I thought this is Disney Marvel. This is going to be a huge machine. And it was like, except for the massive, I'm sure, budget, the film, they were like independent filmmakers. It felt like that.
Wow.
It was like no executives were around. Kevin
Right.
Feige came to the set. We were there April to August 2 years ago. No interference. It wasn't like it was all, it was the director had total control. I mean, I'm sure
Right,
it had
right, right, right.
but it was like being on an independent film. It was so much, you talk about being fun and no pressure and let's do another one and just do something silly. So it was a nice, like when people go, oh, the big bit, it's like, yeah, they
Right,
are.
right,
It
right.
was a great, one of the directors, it was really two, one of the directors, she had a short at Sundance that did really well. That was basically her calling card. And so it wasn't some big, it was great. and silly and fun and yeah. So anyway, but yeah, I'm trying to steer away from horror because it's but it's weird because they'll find you. I was somewhere. Where was
they'll find you? Is so a horror line.
Yeah, they know more about the movies than you do. Like
what
is that? And I was like, okay, but God bless them. They've paid a lot of my mortgages. So
absolutely,
and they're fun to do. They're not scary to do,
of course.
Because I'll watch them like this because of the jump scares. And James Wan is really good at them.
Oh, he's so, like a master, from what I understand. I mean,
yeah, he earns his scares. Like, he'll do a jump scare, but it's a great fucking jump scare.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't like being, I don't like, and it's about evil. And I don't like, it scares the shit out of me. I don't like that. Yeah, I don't mind. Right. The Friday the 13th shit, that's kind of
right. Exactly, a little slasher. I could deal with that.
Yeah, Halloween, that's sure. Fine. But these ones where it's like, yeah, there might be an evil spirit. It's like, yeah, no, thank you.
There's not going to be a Steve Coulter in the audience. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
No. I can't thank you enough for talking to me, man. I had so much fun with you today.
Absolutely. And I'm not coming out loud. I'll trip in Los Angeles next time I'm out there.
So, please, absolutely. Yeah. And
Are you still doing stand up or?
Not really. I always have it on the back burner just because, like, we kind of talked about before, I don't really have my identity tied to any particular art form. I like doing all sorts of different stuff. And sometimes I like to learn how to play guitar just so I know how to do it and then have no ambition of fucking ever playing guitar in front of people. Really. I just like to know how to do things. And stand up for me is something that I found super, super young and was just a refuge for me in all the chaos. And also it felt like a way to hang out with grownups. Like, I was a kid who wanted to grow up so fucking fast and be 40 when I was 4. And I was just like, being a kid is like no freedom and I can't ever do anything. And so listening to adults talk about what it would be like later when you're an adult and hearing those stories and perspectives. And then I got really lucky that I got to be a teenager during stand-up comedy during the Bush administration, the second for me, it shaped. So I mean, I grew up in Texas. I have a very conservative family, but I have very progressive minded parents most part. But for me to hear people like David Cross, Patton Oswalt, Bill Maher,
they were formed from that era.
All those Gen X comedians that weren't famous yet. Even Dave Chappelle was still brand new. And I was already, because I was brought up on Carlin and Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor. And I was taught the old stuff because my parents just liked it. And Steve Martin and stuff. But then I diverted because I was like trying to love these Gen X comics talking about, can you believe what's happening with this war and stuff? And my parents were like, not into that, so I did that on my own.
Well, that makes sense. That's brilliant. A inspiring thought. Yeah, because I mean, Patton Oswalt was a refuge during those years. So I was like, oh my god, someone is saying.
Oh, he and David Cross and that whole kind of group of like Maria Bamford, Brian Posehn, they were all kind of together doing the same, not the same perspective, but the same kind of what they called alternative alt comics at the time. That influenced me really heavily, and so it really informed my attitude. People in my family didn't talk about politics and stuff like that, so that's when I started to kind of get more culturally minded. But then when I went to school the arts, the whole attitude was directing, and I had no concept of how to get involved in stand-up. I was like, do I go to Greensboro to an open mic? I could, but I just didn't. I talked about it for the whole time I was there. I'm like, we're gonna go do that. We never did. And then I would go back to Austin sometimes and go to the home club and do a mic or something. And I did a bunch of stand-up-y things for years. When I got to LA, I wanted to try to treat it like when I learned instruments and be like,
let's try it.
Yeah, let's actually put foot on the pavement. And I did it for 2 years. And then in 2019, in January, as a resolution, I was like, one way or another, I will do stand up every single day of this month. Like, whether I have to go find an open mic or I will do whatever. And there's plenty of it in LA. There's something to do every day. And so I was like, I'm going to do that. And by the end of this month, I will know so much more about whether or not I actually even want to ever spend time trying to make this my job.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it. I hated it. I love performing stand up, But for me, there is so much coupled with it. And this is a thing we don't talk enough about at school that I hope maybe evolves there. It only works with people coming back and telling them, which is you think of the role you will have in a dream situation and not always the environment that you will be in when you get to that dream scenario. You think, oh, I want to be a TV showrunner because I want to write a show and do that. It's like, do you?
You
Because
want
you
to
might
work
not know what
hours a
that
day?
means. And I
Yes.
felt that way about stand-up. I was like, I love this is one of my favorite art forms in the history of people. I love this. I'll never not love it. But spending every night at a bar or at a nightclub style thing and being out till two or three in the morning getting drunk with comics, that's fun sometimes. But for a living every goddamn weekend. And then what if I get successful? I'm going to be traveling all the time in hotels by myself. I'm not built for this. It's okay. Doesn't hurt my feelings. I still think I'm good at it. I ended up opening a comedy club in Austin that I ran for a couple of years.
Where are
But even that, I was like, I don't like administrating this either. It's just,
you?
and there's nothing wrong. And I want to always encourage the reason I even take time at the end of your episode to tell those stories is because I feel like thematically it's kind of built into what we've been talking about, which is give yourself room to have fun and try things on and even play pretend for a little. I played pretend as comedy club owner for a while. It's legitimate, but it was pretend for me because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Yeah, I
And
don't.
to give yourself room to play pretend, man, I think that's the lesson I've kind of learned from you today. I really appreciate it.
Well, yeah, and just enjoy it. And then if it's too hard, then don't do it. Yeah, that thing you're doing, then stop it. If it's, I was like, getting. It's like, then don't do that anymore. If it's just too painful, it's not worth it. I mean, that's like that time to kill thing. That was a point in my life where I thought, I think it's too painful. I don't think I can do this anymore. And then, you just,
Sometimes we have
also,
to walk with those thoughts as they evolve.
yeah, and it's just, I don't know, it helps to have, I don't know if I never really had a mentor, but I've had lucky little, the universe has stepped in. I think during that time, at one point, there's been a guy who said he taught at a private school, and he said, if you ever want to teach, give me a call. And I think around then I did get a call, and he never returned my phone call. This is the universe's
And
way at
if he
work.
had, right?
It had,
Who's to
oh,
say?
definitely, I remember it was like, yeah. So, yeah, that's not it. Just have fun and also allow the universe to step in. Do as much work as you can, but then it's not all up to you. Whether it's a god or some lady named Sally at a desk in New Jersey, I don't know. But there is some kind of magic in the world that will point you where you're supposed to be and kind of put up walls where you're not, where it's, if you've been going at it for a long time and just like you said, that's not the life you wanted. And you did the work. You went back, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna take this month, I'm gonna do this. And like in the world went, thank you for doing that, it was good to do. Instead of because then you don't go, well, man, I never did that. I was gonna do that, I was gonna devote a month or two to do it.
I'm
You just
not, no
now you
regrets
can
on my
go.
deathbed, guy.
Yeah, then because that's the thing. Yeah, you just want to. I'm a big believer in do the work and let the world point you where you're supposed to be. Because if there isn't that kind of a thing in the world, then we're all alone and it's a desperate, sad thing. And I don't want to live like that. Because I've felt that at times. Where I'm sure you have a lot of people. You're like, oh my, there's a great scene in Cool Hand Luke. Jersey.
Pullman.
This thing is a really bad role, Paul Newman, in the movie. And he. It's pouring rain, and the other guy is a big lightning storm, and all the other prisoners are in the truck, and he's out there talking to God, like, just show me, tell me what's going on. And he goes, I'm just standing in the rain talking to myself, and it's like, I hope we're not just standing in the rain. I hope there's something.
Hey, at least we're talking to each other, man, because I think that's where that comes from when we
Yeah,
need
make the
it.
world. I just, yeah, just try to make the world a little bit better. Trying to, because I think, that thing I said about feeling invisible. Oftentimes I'll write, remind myself, try to make someone feel seen today, because someone, it's life, it's a hard world we're living in. And that's funny, but that
I was
puppies.
gonna say, enjoy your puppies. That's the other advice.
It's just that you see, life's so hard, and there's so much, and it's just like to make someone see, whether it's, I know it's corny, but like, person that publics or something, I just go, like, generally, how are you doing? Are you at the end of your shift? Just like we're someone, because we all feel, we all feel unseen. And I think it's one of the things I think, I don't think, movies and TV and theater It's not like, I hate when I just get up there and go, we're storytellers, and our, it's not some, but we can make people feel less alone. And, you know, you can do a story that goes, like, someone goes, oh my God, that's how I wish I would act, or God, that's what I went through. I'm not alone. I do think that is the noble thing in the art form.
Right.
But I think there's in humanity, that's the thing that we can do, is to make people, make the world a little less hard on people. Just,
yeah, you don't have to make art to give people that moment.
No, it's just go, oh, that's a really cool, you know, that's really, I saw, that was really cool what you said then. That's a cool shirt, you know, and
that's one of the, I dated a girl once who told me a story that one of the things she learned from her mom when she was a little girl is one day she got into an elevator with her mom and there was another woman in the elevator and they stood there for a second and her mom kind of looked over and said, I love your bag. It's so cool. And she was like, even when I was like 7 or 8, she wasn't giving some backhanded compliment. It wasn't a dig. There was no agenda. She just genuinely liked the thing that girl had and wanted to let her know. And she calls them elevator compliments. And that's, I love that, which is like, give those elevator. I try to tell every time I genuinely think someone's shirt is cool, I do that exact thing. I'm like, that's dope. I like that.
I feel like I wear glasses. I don't have them here, but I wear glasses, and then I remember, and so, hey man, I like your glasses.
I always just compliment glasses.
Didn't change my life, but for a couple hours, I was like, that's all we need. That's all. Just a little bit, just I feel heard. I feel seen, and you know, it's, yeah, that's what make the world a little bit better. When you die, it's like, was the world a little bit better because you were here, or did you make people's lives a little less better?
Right. Steve, thank you so much.
And I'm sure when I next time I go out to sunny Los Angeles, I'll get about your email then.
Please hit
me
up.
Give me a some coffee or a piece of pie.
You got it, buddy. Thank you. And I appreciate you being so generous with your time.
Patty, was this a strike? I got nothing to do.